Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Thank God for Dennis Kucinich. I had to say that starting off the program today. At least we got one legislator in Washington, D.C. that's got some cojones. Just one. There might be others with semi-cojones, but only one with real ones, okay? Thank God for Dennis Kucinich. He may be doing this in futility, but it's nevertheless, it's a good thing. And maybe, just maybe, might get the public's attention on what a bunch of rotten, no-good thieves are occupying the White House. As if we didn't have enough notice of that already. And we're going to talk about that today. Welcome to the Guy James Show. Glad to have all of you along with us today. So much to talk about. I don't know how in the world we'll get it all in just a couple of hours today. Of course, the big story last night, Dennis Kucinich, 35 counts, having the nerve, the guts, the balls to get up in front of the United States House of Representatives and introduce articles of impeachment against Junior Bush and Dark Cheney. Creating a secret propaganda campaign, Article 1, to manufacture a false case for war against Iraq. Article 2, falsely, systematically, and with criminal intent, conflating the attacks of September 11, 2001, with misrepresentation of Iraq as a security threat as part of a fraudulent justification for a war of aggression. Article 3, misleading the American people and members of Congress to believe Iraq possessed weapons of mass destruction to manufacture a false case for war. Article 4, misleading the American people and members of Congress to believe Iraq posed an imminent threat to the United States. Misspending funds to secretly begin a war of aggression. Invading Iraq in violation of the requirements of Resolution 114. Invading Iraq absent a declaration of war. Invading Iraq, a sovereign nation, in violation of the UN Charter. Failing to provide troops with body armor and vehicle armor. And on, and on, and on, and on. 35 counts. And every one of them makes sense. Imprisoning children, torture, illegal detention, reckless misspending and waste of U.S. tax dollars, violation of the Posse Comitatus Act, spying on American citizens without a court-ordered warrant, directing telecommunications company to create an illegal and unconstitutional database of private telephone numbers and emails of American citizens, announcing the intent to violate laws with signing statements. Failure to comply with congressional subpoenas and instructing former employees not to comply. Tampering with free and fair elections. Corruption of the administration of justice. Conspiracy to violate the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And on and on and on. Resolved that President George W. Bush be impeached for high crimes and misdemeanors, and that the following articles of impeachment be exhibited to the United States Senate. Articles of impeachment exhibited by the House of Representatives of the United States of America in the name of itself and of the people of the United States of America in maintenance and support of its impeachment against President George W. Bush for high crimes and misdemeanors. In his conduct while President of the United States, George W. Bush, in violation of his constitutional oath to faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and, to the best of his ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, and in violation of his constitutional duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed, has committed the following abuses of power, and he lists 35 of them. 35.
The gentleman from Ohio.
I'm going to go forward.
Recognized.
Madam Speaker, pursuant to Clause 2 of Rule 9, I rise to give notice of my intent to raise a question of the privileges of the House. The form of the resolution is as follows. The House is not in order.
Please proceed.
The form of the resolution is as follows. A resolution, articles of impeachment of George Bush, President of the United States. Resolved that President George W. Bush be impeached for high crimes and misdemeanors, and that the following articles of impeachment be exhibited to the United States Senate. Articles of impeachment exhibited by the House of Representatives of the United States of America in the name of itself and of the people of the United States of America in maintenance and support of its impeachment against President George W. Bush for high crimes and misdemeanors. In his conduct while President of the United States, George W. Bush, in violation of his constitutional oath to faithfully execute the office of President of the United States, and to the best of his ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, and in violation of his constitutional duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed, has committed the following abuses of power.
And he lists 35 of them. And I want to thank Dennis Kucinich from the very bottom of my heart for being a man, for doing what 434 other legislators in the House should have done. And I hope he gets some support on it. Of course, I don't have any confidence that he'll get enough support on it. But I'm very grateful to him for bringing this to the floor of the House of Representatives. It's long overdue. We all know that we've been dealing with criminals in the White House for some time. We've known that for a long, long time. We just haven't had anybody with the guts to stand up and finally lay it out for the American public. And oh yes, Dennis Kucinich will be chastised as some sort of a kook, an eccentric, all the things they could bring to fore the right-wing media. We will have the last laugh. This may be a futile effort, but we will have the last laugh. History will not be kind to Junior Bush. We all know that. And I thank Dennis Kucinich very, very much. So much over the weekend. So much happening. And, my God, you know, this Scotty McClellan thing is starting to gain a little traction. I see now he's going to be before the House, before the committee. What is it? Which committee? Anyway, I think a week from Friday. One thing I want you to remember. There's something that we all need to remember, and Fitzgerald, I understand, is willing to testify. If he does, we may learn some things that we haven't known before under oath. I don't know the legalities of what Patrick Fitzgerald is allowed to tell us regarding the testimony of Junior Bush and Dick Cheney and Karl Rove. I don't exactly know. But wouldn't you love to know? And wouldn't you love to know if there ever actually was an indictment of Karl Rove actually prepared and ready to be filed? And then only Fitzgerald and Rove's attorneys know what happened at the last minute. Something sinister at the last minute kept Karl Rove from being indicted over the Valerie Plame affair. And one thing you should mention, or you should remember, rather, is over this Valerie Plame affair, the Bushes got a couple of advantages out of that. Number one, they were able to stick a knife in the back of Joe Wilson because Joe Wilson had found out that their intelligence was faulty, dare I say, misleading or a big fat-ass lie. They were willing to give him the shiv for explaining that and telling the truth about that. And the other thing a lot of people don't seem to remember is that Valerie Plame was working on the Iranian nuclear issue when she was undercover and when she was at the CIA offices, even not undercover. She was working on the Iran nuke issue. So number one, they took out Joe Wilson. And number two, they got rid of an expert on Iran's nukes. So Junior Bush and Dick Cheney could lie their asses off about that as well. So they got two advantages out of that one. Interesting. It will be interesting to see exactly what happens out of this. We've all been led down this path before to think something may happen, and usually it hasn't. And speaking of being led down a path before, I wonder what percentage of American people believe when they're filling up their gas tanks right now at $4.01, $4.10, $4.30 a gallon across the country. And don't give me the BS about, oh, it's cheaper here than it is in Europe. It's more expensive in Europe. Understand this. When they start talking about gas prices in Europe, please understand that most of the reason gas prices are higher in Europe is because of taxes. And what they get for their taxes is health care and a variety of other benefits and educational benefits that we do not have in this country. Do remember that. Everybody likes to conveniently forget that. Push comes to shove, they're not paying any more for the actual petroleum products than we are. It's the extra taxes and what they get for those taxes. And therefore, they have educational benefits in most places for everybody. They have health care benefits in most places for everybody that we don't have. So let's stop the BS about, oh, we've got cheap gas. It's 12 cents a gallon in Venezuela. 12. But how many people, when they're filling up their gas tanks at $4 and some odd cents a gallon now, how many people would be against windfall profit taxes? How many people would actually be against that? Would you be against it? I wouldn't. I plan on talking about that for a while today. As you know, as I have mentioned on this show, and as I have said for a long, long, long time, that we should nationalize the oil companies in this country. Say what you will about that. Call me what you will about that, my ideology and all. That is what we should do. As I have said before, that may not be the greatest capitalistic idea to come down the road for a country with capitalism and democracy like we have, but it may well be an idea that will save this republic. So a debate comes up about windfall taxes on the floor of the United States Senate. $17 billion in tax breaks the companies expect to enjoy over the next decade, once again. They wanted to rescind the $17 billion that they were going to get. And they wanted some windfall taxes. And they wanted to make oil and gas price gouging a federal crime with stiff penalties of up to $5 million during a presidentially declared energy emergency. And they wanted to authorize the Justice Department to bring charges of price fixing against countries that in the OPEC oil cartel. And they wanted to require traders, this is particularly important, to put up more collateral in the energy futures market to curb speculation, which is adding quite a few dollars to the barrel, each barrel of oil. It's estimated right now that approximately $40, maybe more, of every 42-gallon barrel of crude being pumped, that at least $40 of that $130-some-odd dollars we're paying right now is because of wild speculation. And so this is brought before the United States Senate today. And what happens? What happens is, one more time, the Senate Republican blocks something that the Democrats put up. I think it actually passed, I think the number was 51 to 43, but they needed 60 votes to overcome a GOP filibuster and to bring it up for consideration. My question is, why? Why? Why not let them go ahead and filibuster? What is wrong with Harry Reid? Why, oh why, is he intimidated and has to back down one more time from the Republicans who are in the minority? 51-43. But we needed 60 votes. Republican critics said higher taxes on oil companies would increase, not lower, gasoline prices and reduce the incentive for domestic oil exploration and production. We have been giving them tax incentives, $17 billion worth over the last few years, for oil exploration and production. What have they done with it? And somebody please tell me why would anybody believe anything coming out of the mouth of any Republican congressman or senator in the Capitol building saying that oil companies would increase, not lower, gasoline prices? How can this be? Why would anybody believe them? Remember, this is coming from the same bunch of people. The same bunch of people that got Junior Bush into office, the man who said, well, you know, you've got your first MBA president. And Dick Cheney, oil people, and you know, we know all about the oil. I'm paraphrasing now. We know all about the oil business. We'll be able to keep the oil prices down while we're in office. We'll be able to go over and jawbone the Saudi prince. Yeah, that's worked out fine, hasn't it? Who would believe these people about anything? Who would believe? Well, yeah. It's a rhetorical question. I know who would believe them. A 28% of morons. That percentage of people that will vote for John Sidney McCain this time around. Let him filibuster. Let him filibuster, Harry Reid. Do you really think you could lose on the public opinion on this? Do you really? The Senate Majority Leader of the party that's about to take the White House, that's probably going to take some more seats in the Senate, is definitely going to take some more seats in the House. We're in the catbird seat, and Harry Reid, you're afraid to let these clowns filibuster on this? Make them filibuster. Call their bluff. Well, as you know, Harry Reid, not one of my favorite people. Decent guy, all that. Been around him a few times. Very, very conversational. Very, very nice fellow. Senate Majority Leader just doesn't have anything it takes to be the Senate Majority Leader. We need somebody in there now that's combative. Someone that'll fight for what we need to have done. And poor old Harry just hasn't done it. He has just not done it. Been a complete failure, in my opinion. This gas price thing is getting completely out of hand. Think, well, middle class guy used to fill his car up to drive to work. You know, think about the far reaching effects of the gas prices. Here in Florida, for example, we get a lot of tourists here in where I live, just from other parts of Florida. People come from northern Florida or maybe the other coast for something a little different, because it is completely different on the west coast than it is on the east coast. So we get quite a lot of tourists come here in the summertime, in particular, for a vacation, get away from where they live. So the guy from across the state, he can't afford the gas to come visit the beach in Fort Myers this year or Naples. The guy running the hotel doesn't make any money. He cuts back on his spending. He can't afford to trade cars this year. He can't afford to go out to eat. He can't afford to go to the movies or watch a ball game with his kids. He cuts back on groceries. Grocery people are getting laid off at the grocery store, for God's sake. Drugstore people are getting laid off. Hell, even the local flea markets are getting devastated by the economy. And let me tell you, there's no better indicator of the economy than a flea market. And when they aren't making it, things are bad. Really bad. So this gasoline thing goes all across the spectrum. All across. It's killing us all. And so, we get something on the Senate floor to talk about windfall taxes, and the Republicans put a stop to it, and somebody would vote for this party? Tell me why. What in the hell is wrong with anybody that would vote for somebody that would vote against windfall taxes? Now you might say, well, how can you single somebody out? If you're going to have windfall taxes, and that's tax, profit taxes, why not have them against all the big companies that make a lot of money? Well, I would suggest that as soon as you can suggest to me anybody making the kind of money that the oil companies are making. And it's not that they're just making good old-fashioned honest profits. They're taking it out of your hide and my hide. There's nothing fair about it. Nothing fair about it. If you understand the importance of oil to the type of modern capitalism we have in this country, you'll understand a lot. You know, stop and think about all this, how this has gone during this Bush administration. And I'm not naive enough to say I'm going to put all the blame on him and his administration, but there's a lot they could have done about it. There's a lot they could have done looking into the future for alternative fuels, and they haven't done a damn thing. They've been content to let the oil companies rob and rape us, and to hell with the future. That's what they've been content to do. They've been content to be in office for 8 years, take as much, grab as much as they can get for them and their friends, and to hell with whoever follows them up. And screw us. Now, when Bush got into office, oil prices had been somewhat stable for quite a while. Until the end of about 2003, when oil prices were up around $29 a barrel. Oh, think of it, $29 a barrel. And since then, the average price has been steadily upward. Got up to about $57 a barrel in early 2005, and then $75 a barrel, then $100 this year. Now we're up around over $130 last I looked today. But by my crude calculations, that's an increase of over 400%. Do you know of, what else do you know of that's gone up 400%? Have production costs gone up 400%? Has usage gone up 400%? Are there shortages? Are there lines at the pump? Of course, the answer to all those questions is no. And another question, can this continue? Will it continue? Probably not at that rate, because when the oil companies, and you mark my word on this, when the oil companies find the point where we can no longer, you and I, can no longer pay the price, the average person, when they've squeezed every last dollar of cash from us that they possibly can, then the price will level off. That is, until we finally run out of oil. Right now, they're just testing us. How much will we pay? How much can we pay? How much until it absolutely breaks us? You know, it's like people in other times who have owned people, if you know what I mean, or had prisoners. You make sure they get enough to eat so that they can still be productive for you. And that's all. Let them survive. That's all. But you mark my word, they're testing us right now. And when they've squeezed every buck they can from us, they'll level off the prices. Have you noticed how it's gone in plateaus? You remember not too long ago, $2 a gallon. Will oil really get to $2 a gallon? And then it did. Then it receded for a little while. Things were quiet for a while. And then it got over $2 again, and up and up and up and up. And $3 a gallon. Oh, no. Oh, no. It got up to $3 a gallon, and it receded for a little while. And now it's to $4, and it'll probably be going to $5. I don't think a lot of people understand the devastating effect this has on all different kinds of people. It has different effects on different people in this country. You take people that live out in rural areas. I saw that there's some place, and I'm sorry I don't have the name of it, some place in rural Alabama or Mississippi where they figure the price of gas is hurting the folks there more than any other place in the country as opposed to their income. The people there made around $7 an hour on the average, and they're paying, you know, so it's affecting them more than it is anybody. People that live out in the countryside, they've got a longer commute to work. Independent truckers. How'd you like to be an independent trucker right now? But this will all keep going on, and they'll keep squeezing us and testing us until we finally run out of oil. And while these fluctuations around the average trend are due to several factors, such as the war in Iraq, the overall increase has got some other causes. And the principal cause, and it's one we've talked about on this program, is the one that nobody in this useless media that we have today wants to talk about, and that's Hubert's peak. That's the coming decline in world oil production. That's peak oil, what we're talking about, Hubert's peak. And that's the point. And Hubert was this guy, he was a scientist, geologist type guy, clear back in, I don't know, mid-50s. I think 1956, I think it was. He talked about the world finally running out of oil and when it would, and how it would, and the effects that it would have on this country and on the world. And I believe he predicted we would have peak oil in this country, production in this country. I think he predicted it was going to be 1970, and if the figures I've seen are correct, that is when it happened. It was 1970. It was when the United States reached their highest production level, and it's been down ever since. But Hubert's peak is the point at which half of all the available oil is used up and the total supply starts to decline. So we've reached the highest level and now we're starting to go down. And we will run out of oil. There's little question of it. The answer to that, when? I don't know when. But peak oil for the entire world is he predicts, somewhere between now and probably 2015, and it looks like we're well on the way to that, and even the Saudis are suspected of highly inflating their oil reserves. It is believed that for them to hold sway the way they do in OPEC, that they've inflated their oil reserves, and they don't really have the reserves they say they do, or they can't really recover all the reserves that they say they do. So we may be approaching peak oil faster than a lot of people think. And that's okay. When it happens, it happens. And India and China and the rest of the world, they're using more oil than we have. But we're doing nothing. We're doing nothing for those that succeed us on this earth. We're doing nothing for them. We're greedily using up the natural resources on this planet, and the money that we're spending right now on exploring alternative energy is practically nothing. It's a drop in the bucket. It's what it ought to be. We're inventive people. We're resourceful people. We could certainly come up, and will. I believe that we will come up with something. We're not going to come up with something to replace all the things we use oil for. We will not. We'll drastically have to alter our lifestyle. There will not be tens of millions of automobiles running around in this country 100 years from now. It won't happen. There will have to be mass transit. We're not going to enjoy the personal freedom of a household automobile for everybody, or maybe two. Life will change. But humanity will adapt to that. Here in this country, we'll adapt to that. I've seen it. I've enjoyed it in other places that have gone and enjoyed the benefits of mass traffic and transit. It's not so bad. So something like that will have to happen in this country. It's inevitable. And in other developed countries in the world as well. But my problem is we're just not doing anything about it right now. We're not doing anything about it. And what we're hearing from the Republicans, the hue and cry, and I get email from them every day, and people in their, you know, their think tanks, drill, 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 drill. Let's hit Anwar. Let's hit out the shelf. Let's drill out in the Gulf. Let's just pepper the place with oil wells. Okay. I've heard it best. We can replace, what, 1, maybe 2% of the oil we need. We're currently using 20 million barrels of oil a day. 20 million barrels. What is it, something like 2/3 of it being imported into this country? No amount of drilling that we can do is going to replace all that. A Band-Aid? Yes. A long time Band-Aid away, because as we all know, and even the oil people will admit it, it's usually about 10 years from exploration to production in an oil well or an oil field. So drill, 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 that isn't going to do a damn thing for the price of gas right now. It isn't going to do anything. Nothing at all. We're a decade away. Something has to be done now. Absolutely, something has to be done right now. I don't know where this is all going to end up. And if you got any ideas, I'd love to hear from you. 866-546-5254. You know, as the demand continues to climb and the major oil corporations and the world approaches Hubert's Peak, the peak oil, several things are going to happen, and several things are happening. Prices will climb steadily. It's going to have a direct impact on all the economies in the world, every one of them. The U.S. cost of living is going to increase. Consumer spending on homes, on all kinds of durable goods and other items will decline. Unemployment's going to increase. Long, long time ago, economic experts predicted this could result in a period of stagflation or as a lot of experts are starting to whisper now, a depression. And it's beginning to look as though they're right on the money, doesn't it? Second thing will happen is the profits will continue to surge. Rising price of oil and all its products is hurting the world, the people of the world, the working people. And it's resulting in massive, obscene profits for the oil companies. Cost of production isn't changed in the short run by these declining supplies. And the third thing that's going to happen is the corporations won't be able to find enough new supplies to meet demand, and so they'll use their profits to buy up other corporations to increase their reserves. And that's already started. These oil companies are flush with cash. The big fish are swallowing up the little fish. And they'll seek their growth through acquisition rather than going out and exploring. They'll buy known reserves. Not so long ago, Chevron Texaco ate up, what was it, Unocal? $16, $17 billion, something like that. There's going to be a lot more acquisitions on the way. And we're going to become even more dependent on oil produced in OPEC countries. And the U.S. capitalism will be even more likely to intervene for the sake of control wars. The most likely target right now is Iran, followed by Venezuela. It will happen. It will happen. Think of the problem that's going to cause. Let's head on over to the phone line. Hi, you're on the Guy James Show.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, Guy. This is Bob in Hurley, Wisconsin.
Hi, Bob.
I think you're beating a dead horse, as you say, nationalized. I think you're beating a dead horse when you talk about windfall profits. I suggest it's a nice, simple thing that we could do to, in fact, take a real punch at the oil companies, and it'd be quick and easy. All you do is pass a federal law requiring that all vehicles over, say, 3,000 pounds, or that have EPA mileage figures of, say, under 30 miles per gallon, have to obey the truck speed limit. There's no cost to it. And as it slows those vehicles down, they will save approximately 25% of their fuel.
Well, it helps. It certainly helps.
If that doesn't, in fact, impact the you know, if you think of it as supply and demand, that would, in fact, have to have some effect on the demand side of that equation.
Well, I think it would, and it did help. And by the way, personally, I have personally done that. I might have mentioned last week, I think, on the show that I'm one of those ones that have had a lead foot. I don't anymore. I have strictly observed the speed limit and use cruise much more, and I'm getting significantly better gas mileage, by the way. But what are we going to do with all the people who can't afford to go out and buy one of those 30-mile-gallon cars?
Well, bottom line is that they can choose to drive slower.
Oh yeah, but if you live out in rural America someplace and you're driving a 1977 Buick Electra, and that's all you could afford, you know, you're stuck.
No, the bottom line is that at $4 per gallon, if you're saving 25% of the on mileage, that's like giving yourself a $1 discount on the cost of a gallon of gas.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, you're absolutely right.
If it doesn't help the working stiff, I don't know what does. And what it comes out is if you want to take a big old V8 pickup truck with dualies and drive it at 80 miles per hour, you deserve to pay the ticket.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, the oil companies aren't going to suffer any through that. The law of supply and demand, when you own all of something, you can dole it out as you want for whatever price you want, and, you know, they're not going to be deterred. They're pretty much in the catbird seat right now.
Well, the bottom line is that does do something about the energy problem.
It does. Do you remember back, what was it, during the Carter administration when they dropped the interstates from 70 down to... 60 or 55, it had an effect.
Yes, it did. And today, as I drive down two-lane highways, I kind of get a kick out of going 55 because I'm not only saving 25% on my gasoline, but when I stack six or seven cars up behind me, I'm saving fuel in all those cars, too.
I live about a mile and a half from Interstate 75, you know, as you know, that runs all the way to the tip of Michigan, all the way to Miami, Florida. And you try running 55 on there, they're going to shove you off the road. It's really something, people.
It is outrageous.
Yeah, it is.
The bottom line is that everybody has the ability to write themselves a $1 discount on gasoline. All they have to do is slow down.
Yeah. Well,
it's the American public actually believes that, in fact, gas prices are too high. They will do that and write themselves a discount.
It's working for me. It really is.
Mm-hmm. And I think it'd be a heck of a good idea to... You see, if they can't lower the price of the speed limit everywhere, because then some bozo in Washington is going to, in fact, get a no-bid contract to replace all those signs. It's
going to
cost us an arm and a leg.
Yeah,
just passed a law saying that larger cars and trucks have to obey the truck speed limit. Then, in fact, you've done some things. First of all, you collect all that fine money from the people who choose to speed. Secondly, in fact, you've given people a reason to buy a Prius that they can drive at 70 miles per hour on the expressway rather than 55.
Yeah.
If you're in a hurry, pay for it.
Don't know anybody that owns a Prius. I've been wanting to really have a conversation with somebody and see how it's working out and maintenance and the expected life of the car and all that. I'd like to get a comprehensive story on the Prius and see what the total cost of running one of those cars is.
Well, I'm a fat old guy and I don't fit in one. I bump my head every time I get in.
Well, that's the trouble with all the newer cars, though. But the headroom getting in them, the sloped windshields, man, that really does a number. I know exactly what you're talking about on that.
But I have a little pickup truck that I fit into very easily.
Yeah.
And it gets 33, 34 miles per gallon on the expressways.
Yeah. Well, I'm discovering that as well. My car, I didn't think would get that good of mileage, but it'll do 33, 34 miles an hour out on the interstate now. So. Yep, I'm doing it, and thanks for the suggestion. That's a lot of people think about it. It'll work. It'll help anyway.
Idea. If enough people talk to their congressman, maybe they'd take it up.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call.
Bye-bye.
That is one idea. Everybody ought to really think about doing that. Believe me, it does work. And I know some of you have different situations and all that. It might not different. But I made myself a little promise here a while back that I will not violate the speed limit. And in fact, one road coming home from the other office, it has a 45-mile-an-hour speed limit, and I feel like I should give me some of those wraparound sunglasses that all the old-timers wear down here and wear a pair of those. I actually have a very red, sporty car. I might look like, I don't know, I don't want to look like one of those really old codgers driving around, but I'll set the cruise on 45 miles an hour coming on that. And you know what? It only takes another 5 minutes or so to get home. So then that is a thought, and that's a good thing. We all do need to slow down a little bit. We may not need to travel quite as fast as we do, and it is working for me. I'm getting another four, maybe almost 5 miles to gallon slowing down, so it does work. Hey, we're going to pause for a break right now. You're listening to the Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network, and we'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
John McCain has done more than just embrace George Bush's failed policy in Iraq. It's actually his idea to escalate the war there. It's John McCain's idea to send tens of thousands more soldiers to Iraq and to keep them there with no timeline for bringing them home. The McCain plan to escalate, going from bad to worse.
I dig rock and roll music and love to get the chance to play
and sing it.
I figure it's about the happiest sound.
Everybody slow down. That's right. Hey, thanks for joining us here on the Guy James Show today. That's a good idea. That is a good idea. It's something that we're not hearing much right now, and this might be a good place to start. We'll have an all-out campaign on the show, but slow down. We'll do our part. We'll do our part. But also, I still want to nationalize the oil companies. I do. Don't write me and think and say, hey, you're nuts, we can't do that and all that. We can. There are countries that have nice nationalized oil working out really well for them. Yeah, I really think a starting point for all this, besides slowing down, is for dealing with all these problems is to nationalize the oil companies in the U.S. and use the profits from the oil production to convert to mass transit and some sort of renewable energy. And in the process, you know, we have better benefits. We dramatically reduce greenhouse gas emissions as well. And then the nationalization would permit a nice transition for the oil workers, say, for away from the oil production to renewable energy. Because that energy's industry, the oil industry, is going to be systematically reduced. But the path of these idiots that we've got in office right now, Bush and Cheney and all, it's going to lead to this massive accumulation of wealth for the capitalist politicians, for their base, for the rich and the super rich, and for the rest of us. It's going to lead to an environmental catastrophe and economic catastrophe. And it's happening as we speak. And I think the question is, will we continue to allow this to happen? Are we the frogs in the boiling water? I think we are. You've heard the old story about the frog in the boiling pot of water. First, he's just thinking he's in a nice warm bath, and it gets hotter and hotter and hotter, and finally, it's too damn late to get out. He's a cooked frog. And that's what's happening to us. And the question really is, are we going to continue to allow this to happen? Are we going to continue to let the Harry Reids and the people in our Congress do nothing? And you can ask the question, is nationalizing the oil companies the right thing to do? Is it the ideal thing for a capitalistic nation to do? Probably not. But the alternative seems to be financial ruin for the great majority of people in this country. And which matters most? The people in this country or the oil companies? That's what it comes down to. We need to put people before profits. And that's something that this administration and this Republican group that's been running things for a long time now doesn't know a damn thing about. And you can talk all you want to about the Democrats having control of Congress in the past nearly 2 years, and that's true, but you look at what the Republicans have done to throw up every roadblock that they possibly can. $20 million barrels a day to feed our addiction to oil. And two-thirds of that $20 million barrels a day is for cars and trucks. And we're feeling the squeeze in so many different ways right now. Do you fly at all? Do you take the family vacation? Do you have to take a business trip now and then, as I do now and then? Have you seen the price of airline tickets lately? Oh my God. It's crazy. Crazy. So that's having an effect on you. Every time you fill up your car, it's having an effect on you. Everything the trucking companies hauling your groceries in, that's having an effect on you. And yes, even some of the mass transit. I notice here we have a very good bus system in Lee County, Florida. And they're having problems because of fuel prices. It's a tough economy right now. Got all the households and businesses facing higher bills. And everybody wants somebody to blame. And the country's politicians, who depend on their votes, are more than willing to point the finger on their behalf. So everybody's looking at OPEC right now. I don't think we've seen the end of it. Not at all. I don't think we're close to seeing it level off anytime soon. The Saudis do lead OPEC. Chavez would like to have a better say in OPEC. And if Chavez and Ahmadinejad and get too much power in OPEC, they'll use it as a weapon against America. You better believe they will. But for right now, it's King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia who's really calling the shots. Bushy went over there recently, and he got us another 300,000 barrels a day. Oh, boy, that's a drop in the bucket. Didn't work out so well for him. Not so well at all. 866-546-5254. 866-546-5254. We enjoy getting your calls. Does make you wonder, and I certainly spend my time, a lot of my time thinking about it, the old American dream. Is it completely going away? Do you even recognize this country as to, compared to what it was not so terribly long ago? We might not any longer be the land of economic optimism. A lot of Americans, people that I've talked to. I had a chance over the weekend to speak to many people about their economic standing in the country and how things are going for them right now. And there's a lot of people that feel the American dream is completely unraveling. Everybody once thought that, almost everybody once thought that they were going to do better and be more well off in the future. And I saw a USA Today poll that finds that 54% of those surveyed say that their standard of living is no better today than it was 5 years ago. Hey, a hell of a lot of people would be happy to have their standard of living just the same as it was 5 years ago. There's a lot of people whose standard of living has gone down, way down. A lot of people have lost their homes, their jobs, their benefits, their insurance. But the CNN opinion research poll showed that 78% of respondents believe that the current state of the nation's economy is poor or very poor. 19% think the economy is somewhat good, and only 3% say it's very good. What universe are they living in? And only 46% of the respondents expect conditions to be somewhat good at this time next year. So you can see optimism for the future for the American dream isn't so well off either. This Bush stimulus package that was meant to bolster consumer spending and kind of kickstart growth has instead so far been used by many Americans to pay off bills and debt. And what's the conservative response to all that? Junior Bush and his key advisors? I swear, they seem to be living in a different America than the rest of us. They've so far aren't admitting anyway that they can see the stagnant wages and the credit crunch and the terrible housing market and the grocery store prices. I found a quote just from the other day where Bush said that our economy is still, quote, continuing to grow in the face of unprecedented challenges because of its large and its open and its flexibility. And Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson argued that we're on the right path to resolving market disruptions. But Junior Bush and his people in Washington can stand there and say, all day long, that things are improving and that things aren't so bad and all. Well, you go out and ask the man on the street, they'll tell you a different story. Even had White House Press Secretary Dana Perino the other day saying that America's economy has time to sit around and wait for things to improve. He said we'd ask the economy to act on the things we think would have an impact. Not necessarily an immediate impact, but an impact. So that the future of our economy can continue to grow. The future of our economy. Hey, we need something now. Now. People are losing their homes now. People are losing their jobs now. People aren't able to send their kids to college now. They're losing their insurance benefits now. Don't tell me we have to look in the, for the next decade to do something about the economy for the middle American. Don't tell me we have to wait till 5 years from now, even 1 year from now. We need something now. And yet many of these politicians, the corporatists, who've done everything they can to help corporate America, everything they can to help the oil industry, they're able to take that stand on everything and yet continue to turn around and look to us and ask us for their vote to keep them in office? Give me a break. I don't know. I don't know if this great and grand experiment of ours in this country is I do sometimes wonder. As you know, I've got a lot of love and faith for this country, faith in this country, but I've not seen it like this in my lifetime. I have not. We're going to pause for news at the top of the hour. We'll be back in, I don't know, about 5 minutes. Hang on that long if you can, and when you come back, give us a call. Here on the Guy James Show and the Head On Radio Network. We'll be waiting for you at 866-546-5254. News coming up next.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The AFL-CIO says the U.S. economy is in free fall and is urging Congress to act with urgency to help working people hit the hardest by it. The AFL-CIO wants unemployment benefits extended immediately. With $4 gas, millions of homes headed into foreclosure, and high numbers of long-term unemployed, the Labor Federation says it's shameful that Congress has not yet extended unemployment benefits. More than 1.5 million Americans are suffering long-term joblessness. 37% of unemployed workers are now exhausting their regular state unemployment benefits without finding new work. That's a higher number than in the last recession. A labor environmental coalition wants private drinking water wells in Deepwater, New Jersey, tested for possible DuPont chemical contamination. DuPont reported to the state of New Jersey that levels for the chemical used to make Teflon, PFOA, exceed the state's alert level limits for groundwater in that area. The United Steelworkers Union says 750 private drinking water wells may be contaminated by high levels of PFOA, and they should be tested. Industries dependent on fuel fight back in Europe. Jesse Russell reports.
Earlier this year, President George W. Bush said he didn't think the United States would see an average fuel price of $4 per gallon. Well, contrary to the president's wishful thinking, that day has come, and the spiking cost of oil isn't only hitting Americans hard. In Europe, motorists are seeing prices nearly double what it is in the States. Some 70,000 Spanish truckers on Monday formed a blockade along the border with France, bringing traffic in and out of the country to a virtual standstill. And in France, truckers began easing off the gas and slowing traffic in advance of a planned national strike next week. European countries apply higher taxes on fuel cost, and as a result, truckers in Europe are paying on average the equivalent of $7.73 per gallon. As a result of the strike, late on Monday, gas stations in northeastern Spain began running out of fuel. According to Spanish news reports, many vehicles that attempted to cross the truckers' blockade ended up with smashed windshields or slashed tires. Here's today's economic report. It may not be easy being green, but in this recession, it helps. A new report by Acre Resources has found that jobs in the environmental sector have grown by nearly 20% during the past year, while other industries see a slowdown. Not only are companies hiring for green workers and professionals who can help reduce their carbon footprint, banks are often more willing to lend for green sector initiatives.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
If you don't clean up your room, the Board of Health is going to condemn it.
The Board of Health doesn't even know about your room. What's more, they don't care.
You know, if you keep making that face, it's going to freeze that way.
Not unless you're someplace really, really cold. Actually, a lot of the warnings moms hand out are a bit exaggerated.
If you don't get your blood pressure checked, you could have high blood pressure, not even know it, and you could die from a stroke.
But she's right about that one. Fact is, high blood pressure contributes to 200,000 American deaths each year, and a third of those who have high blood pressure don't know it. If they did, it'd be simple to treat. Call the American Heart Association at 1-800-AHA-USA1 or visit AmericanHeart.org on the web to learn more. Better still, ask your doctor to check your blood pressure.
If you run with those scissors,
it's the least you can do.
Hey, John, I just heard you got a new computer. Congratulations.
Thanks. It's the coolest thing.
What'll you do with your old computer?
I don't know. I guess I'll just throw it away.
Well, my company just bought new computers, and we decided to donate the old PCs to a place that gives them to local schools. You can do something like that.
Seriously, who would want a 3-year-old computer?
Hey, it might be great for someone else. Computers can be refurbished and reused instead of ending up in the trash. By passing it on, you can help the community and the environment.
If you're replacing your company's IT equipment or you're finished using your personal computer, pass it on to a local organization that accepts computers. To learn more, log on to epa.gov/passiton. This message was brought to you by EPA, Dell, Intel, HP, NEC, Philips, and this radio station on behalf of EPA's Plug Into eCycling Partnership. EPA does not endorse any commercial services or products of these groups. For information on all partners, log on to epa.gov/plugin.
Show is on in less than 1 minute.
Fly! Fly, you hear me? Give my creation! Fly!
So this was fun.
You're gonna like this.
Let go!
Right now!
Well, this is it.
Let's get this over with.
So this is good. We got progress.
Any questions before we proceed?
Get countdown. 6... 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
You have entered the restricted broadcast area. You have entered the restricted broadcast.
What your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show. Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Hey, welcome back to the Guy James Show. So glad to have each and every one of you along with us this afternoon. I see we've got a great audience today, and we hope some of you will participate in the program today. 866-546-5254. We'd love to have you give us a call and give us your opinions on anything we have to say, or maybe even what you have to say. just a quick reference. Did you see that Bill Moyers deal? I forget where I saw it last night, where O'Reilly, he should learn by now. He sent one of his idiot producers into ambush Bill Moyers, and Bill Moyers ate him up and spit him out in little pieces. Did you see that? Listen, anybody not smart enough to know that they can't get away with that with Bill Moyers is just an imbecile. That includes Mr. O'Reilly. Ben. Lots of interesting things came on today, and I wanted to mention one more time. talked a lot about the coming general election coming up, and of course the House of Representatives, everybody's running, and the Senate, about a third of them running, and we are going to pick up. And I see some of the Republicans are even saying the Democrats might pick up 8 seats in the Senate. Man, I don't know. That'd be all right. That'd be really all right. But I was telling somebody the other day, I'm not sure everybody understands, and I'm not sure everybody's had the experience, but growing up in a rural environment, growing up on a farm, okay, you had a chance to be around a lot of silos and granaries and that sort of thing. And when you're a youngster, you're usually charged with the job of going in and cleaning those bins out after they've hauled away most of the wheat or corn or oats or whatever was in it. Or you've emptied the bin. There's always some laying around, and they always send the kids in to sweep up and clean them out real good, so that there's, there's no problem. Well, invariably, and I don't want to get too descriptive about this, but invariably on the farm or around a grain elevator or anything like that, there's a lot of rodents. And you keep them down as best you can. That's why everybody's got cats and dogs and so forth around the farm in those days. And you get up into a grain bin, and let me tell you, there's nothing quite so frightening for a young kid, skinny young lad like myself. You go up into a grain bin with your shovel and your broom, and you're going to clean it out, and you look over into the dark corner, and there's a rat over there. And I'm going to build a little analogy here. Now, a rat's just a small thing. Very small. I don't know, a couple of pounds at the most. Even a big one. But you've never seen anything more fearsome. When they talk about a cornered rat is a spectacle to see. They'll bare their teeth, and they'll come after you. Yeah. 2-pound rat will come after you. Fearsome-looking thing. Scare the hell out of most people. As people in the ghettos, and yes, I'll use that word today. But these rats will come after you. And that's what's going to happen in this general election coming up. You're going to see some fearsome rats, and I'm going to talk about some of those rats in just a minute, and I'm talking about Republican rats. They're going to throw every dirty, rotten, no good tactic at the Democrats that they possibly can. It's going to get ugly. Real ugly. And I want you to keep that in mind. When you see the propaganda coming out and their PACs and all that start spending money and do the swift voting and all that sort of thing, it'll get ugly. But I think they run up against somebody, and either way that this campaign went, whether Barack or Hillary wanted either one of them wasn't going to take that treatment like Al Gore and John Kerry did, so could get pretty interesting. And let's head on over to the phone. Hi, you're on the Guy James Show.
Hey, Dave out here in Northern Cal.
Hi, Dave.
Before you leave altogether this subject of impeachment, I'm wondering, have you found any of the media aware of it? Is anybody paying attention to this? I'm not finding it here in any of our California press.
Oh, not much, no. They're not going to give it any press. You know how that goes.
They don't think it's newsworthy, I guess.
No, they don't. They sure don't.
That says an awful lot to me. That is newsworthy.
Yeah, I think so, too. But they, they're just not willing to put any credence behind it at all. They're continuing to be the, nice little lackey media that they've been all along to the Bush administration. They just don't want to seem to give it up for some reason.
Have we heard anything on this subject from either Obama or Hillary?
No, and you won't.
Somebody's indicated here in the chat room that McCain has indicated that he's opposed to it. The key value wasn't supposed to say a word about it either. That's implying that it's happening. But
yeah, I'm surprised he even made a comment about it.
Yeah, right. He does tend to stick his foot in his mouth every now and then.
Yeah, you're not going to hear much about it. I think Wexler may have signed on with it, and a couple of other people, but you're not going to hear a lot about it. But I'm still thankful for Dennis to have the guts to go ahead and do it. I'm proud of him, real proud of him.
I am too. I mean, that man should definitely be right at the top for our candidate for president of this country. He's the man that addresses the reality that needs to be addressed.
Yeah.
He doesn't get stepped on and held under and put in a closet. He speaks out. And I so value him. Yes, and so do you, I know.
Yep, absolutely. I admire him greatly. You know, he's an eccentric guy. He's got his quirks, all that. But Dennis, when it comes right down to it, one of the biggest thinkers on Capitol Hill. No question, he's one of the biggest thinkers. And he's also is a man probably more aware of what this country's supposed to be and what the Constitution is supposed to be than probably anybody else on Capitol Hill.
You know, it blows my mind that some of the people that we respect the most, you know, and even like, is it Ted Kennedy saying anything about this?
Ted's kind of out of action right now.
Well, I know he's got his personal problems, but, you know, those people that we count on to speak out, where are they, you know?
Yeah.
We have an impeachment being brought before us, and they're pretending it isn't happening.
Oh, you know, Dave, it's an election year, and everybody wants to be so politically correct. It makes me sick, but that's what's going on. You know, and I know it. They're just gonna pretend like it didn't happen and just be Mr. Nicey Nice to everybody. Dave, it reminds me of course, most of them are lawyers, but I was going to say it reminds me of two lawyers going into a court fight against one another, and before the jury and the gallery and the judge, they put up a ferocious fight against one another, and then you can usually find them around the corner from the courthouse in a bar after the thing having a drink together. And that's just what that little fraternity up on Capitol Hill is, just what they are. They're not going to do a whole lot to offend one another.
Well, we've got criminals in our White House. They need to be impeached. One member of Congress is bringing it out, and everybody else is sticking their head in the sand and pretending it isn't happening. And that is also criminal. You're having another wonderful show, as always, guys. Please stay with it. Keep up your good effort.
Thanks, Dave. Good to hear from you.
Where else would we even hear that there was an impeachment effort?
Yeah. Well, I sat there and watched it all last night. It was great.
Good man, guy.
Thanks, Dave. Well, Corey Stone reminds me on the chat room that a 2-pound rat would be a lightweight. I told him I never actually weighed one. Oh, yeah. And thanks, Dave. Thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. Yeah, the politicos in Washington, they're not gonna say anything. They're not gonna identify themselves with this effort by Dennis Kucinich. They're too big and too powerful and too civil to one another to do that. Oh, Dennis Kucinich has brought up something. Oh, well, you know, that's Dennis Kucinich. We're not gonna comment on that because we're too civil to one another. My good friend, my colleague. Yes, the civility of the House and the Senate. Boy, would I like to be on that floor for a while as a United States Senator. It's just like the other day when Obama. I know. I'm probably the one. I wouldn't last 10 minutes, maybe, huh? But is it like the other day when Obama had the problem with Joe Lieberman, that SOB, Lieberman? Oh boy! How, you know, he took him over to the corner and had a stern talk with him. They said, then they shook hands afterwards. I wouldn't take him over to the corner and have a stern, quiet little talk. I'd call him out. I'd call him out on the Senate floor right then and there. I would. And then the press would be after me. But I'd only last one term. Or get impeached during that first term for being uncivil to my colleagues because they had it coming. Once in a while, a little of that does happen on the House floor. I think Cheney told somebody F you one time. And, you know, there's that kind of stuff. But they're far too nice to each other when they shouldn't be sometimes, in my opinion. Have you seen the story that surfaced once again over the weekend about Jack Abramoff? You know, Jack Abramoff is the Republican gift that just keeps on giving. And as you all know, and of course we must believe that this, because Junior Bush said so, and he, after all, is the President of the United States. God help us. And we all know, and he said it, so it must be true, that he didn't even know Jack Abramoff, right? Didn't know him. Didn't know him. That was his first comment all about Jack Abramoff. No, I don't know any Jack Abramoff. I don't know him. And then it turns out that he'd met with him twice, that they acknowledged. And now they find out that the president himself met with Abramoff on at least six occasions. Mm-hmm. Why would Junior Bush meet with this great thief and fraud and con artist, Jack Abramoff, six times in the White House? Tell me that. Why would the President of the United States have a reason to meet with Jack Abramoff, the highly criminal Republican doing time right now, for disgusting so many disgusting things? Why would the President of the United States meet with him six times? Well, I think you know why. And I know why. And any reasonable person knows why he would meet with Jack Abramoff six times. Because Jack Abramoff was linked up to them real nice-like, if you know what I mean. He was doing favors for them. They were doing favors for him. Yeah. And it turns out that they find out White House officials were getting tickets to events from Abramoff and his associates. Hey, I need some NCAA basketball tournament game tickets to the Washington Wizards, tickets to the Baltimore Orioles. And in this new draft report, the committee that investigated this found out that Abramoff and his associates had billed clients for 485 contacts with the White House. You heard that right. 485 contacts with the White House Abramoff billed his clients for. Now, while it may be true that Abramoff might have just been billing people for contacts that he didn't really have, investigators have found out that at least 70 of those contacts for sure had taken place between Abramoff's team and the White House officials. Okay? At least 70. And we have the White House spokesman, Tony Fratto, saying, Abramoff carried no weight here, as the report makes clear. Well, I'm sorry, but that's just not how it is, you see. They found that 19 instances in which White House officials asked for tickets to events from Abramoff and his associates. Why? Why would that be? This is from the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee. They're not allowed to receive gifts worth more than $20 each, and not allowed to take more than $50 from a single source in 1 year. But they did. Add this to the fact that we have an eyewitness, somebody that's involved with Jack Abramoff, that says that Karl Rove met with him on street corners. Said the street corner meetings were easier and not so detectable. A representative from the Tigwa tribe of Texas, one of Jack Abramoff's former clients, says that he witnessed a clandestine meeting between the lobbyist and Karl Rove on the street just outside the White House, and that Abramoff said he and Rove regularly met in such ways in order to stay below the radar. This account comes in James Moore and Wayne Slater's new book called The Architect, Karl Rove and the Master Plan for Absolute Power. Schwartz told them that he was visiting Abramoff in Washington in March of 2002 when, in the midst of a conversation with Abramoff in the back seat of the lobbyist car, Abramoff suddenly said, "I gotta meet Rove." The car headed in the direction of the White House, but stopped short at a street corner, where Schwartz says he saw Rove standing outside. As the car came to a stop, Abramoff stepped out, and Schwartz lowered his window. The first part of the conversation between Abramoff and Karl Rove was easily heard. "We've got a problem, Jack," Rove mentioned a member of the House who was not cooperating on a piece of legislation. Schwartz was unable to hear the congressperson's name, and Rove went on to say, "And this is getting really out of hand. We need to clamp down. We need this to stop. Can you put the fireman, Tom DeLay, on this and let Tom know we need this ended? This is not good for us." "You bet," Abramoff told the presidential advisor. "Taken care of. Not a problem on it." Schwartz then raised his window because the conversation he just heard sounded private. But when Schwartz later asked Abramoff why he'd met Rove on the street, Schwartz says Abramoff replied, "Yeah, it's just easier. Like I said, everything that comes out of the White House is logged in. The phone calls he makes, the phone calls he receives. So this is just easier. It keeps things a lot cleaner." And he's a fat expletive deleted here. "And he can use the exercise. If the weather's nice, we meet in a couple of spots, and if not, he'll drive over and come through Signatures," that's Abramoff Restaurant, "or one of the other spots." Perhaps this is the answer to why the Secret Service visitor record showed so few visits by Abramoff, only 7. According to Moore, Rove denied that the meeting occurred. For his part, Schwartz says he told federal investigators the same story when he was interviewed. This is not the first news of meetings between Abramoff and Rove, of course. Former Abramoff associates have detailed contacts between the two, including a conversation setting up a meeting between the Malaysian ambassador and President Bush. But no street corner meetings. Well, well, well. And now we know for a fact that Junior Bush, who didn't know Abramoff at all, and later was found to have, oh gosh, I must have misremembered, 2 meetings with him. Now we know he had at least 8. Or 6, was it? Yeah, on at least 6 occasions. Okay. And people still believe anything at all coming from these people? Still believe it? If you're into Karl Rove stories, I found this one interesting. I'd like to know, is this really true? It comes from a new book by former Time magazine reporter Paul Alexander. It says that when Karl Rove left his job at the White House in August of 2007, he told the Washington Post, "I'm leaving on my own terms. But Paul Alexander claims that Bush actually fired Rove, telling him, "It's time for you to go," during the summer of 2007. And let me quote from the book from Paul Alexander from Time magazine. "On a Sunday in midsummer, George W. Bush accompanied Karl Rove to the Episcopalian church Rove sometimes attended," writes Alexander. "They made their way to the front of the church of the congregation. Then, during their time in the church, Bush gave Rove some stunning news. Bush said, 'There's too much heat on you. It's time for you to go.'" So, according to this book by Time magazine author, Bush fired Karl Rove in church. Ah, yes. Sweet, isn't it? 866-546-5254. I got to tell you, that's a beauty. Hey, John McCain, a lot of people angry with me because I said maybe he's too old or maybe a little bit senile or something to be running for president. Have you heard this one?
I was in a conference in Germany over the weekend, and the President Putin of Germany gave one of the old Cold War style speeches as he addressed the conference there.
Just in case you didn't hear that the first time. Well.
I was in a conference in Germany over the weekend, and the President Putin of Germany gave one of the old Cold War style speeches as he addressed the conference there.
Well, we're all in on some inside information. Pooty Poot has moved from Russia to Germany now. He's the President of Germany. I hadn't realized it. I don't think any of us had realized that, except for John McCain. My goodness. Is he in good enough shape to run for president of the United States? I do wonder. I do wonder. And I ran across this story today that I felt was absolutely outrageous. Certain people in this country like to talk about family values, American family values. And I thought this, this piece is just absolutely egregious. These days, it's not just justice wearing the blindfold, it's the law. The people enforce it, and the great majority of the people who don't give a damn. The country of refugees and pilgrims is more dedicated to the letter of the law than anything else. At least as far as immigration is concerned. True, industry may look the other way because we couldn't afford to eat without illegal immigrants. But when it comes to the educated, the motivated, and the talented, we're not willing to make any accommodation. We're not willing to offer any alternative route to citizenship, no matter how someone's skills might benefit the country. Listen to this. Arthur McCoyan, a 4.0 high school valedictorian from Fresno, California. He speaks only English, and since he was a baby, knows only the United States. We can't wait to send him and his parents back to what used to be the Soviet Union whence his parents fled for their lives. They were never granted that asylum, although any Cuban looking for better opportunities would be granted that asylum if he can get here illegally. All appeals having run out after all these years, and the American kid has to be deported to a country he doesn't even know, and where he's an illiterate alien doomed to a life of misery, freedom wins again. Now, because they wish to be merciful, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency has allowed him out of jail to attend his graduation and make his valedictory speech before he's discarded like a bag of garbage. Of course, his younger brother is a legal citizen, having been born here. So the family may have to be broken up, but who cares? It's all in a day's work for the Immigration and Customs folks. I don't know when I've heard a worse story about values in this country than that one right there. A young man who's worked hard to get a 4.0 grade point average, to be the valedictorian of his high school class. And his crime? His crime for being deported in this country? His crime is coming here with his parents when he was a baby, not knowing where he was at or not knowing anything. What do they think? He's a Russian spy? I hope to God somebody steps in and does something about this. I hope they won't let this actually happen. So far, it looks like it's going to. But we brag about Christian values in this country. And the party in power in the White House brags about Christian values in this country. If the President of the United States gets a hold of this story, I certainly would think he would have the compassion to look at this and do the right thing. Very ugly story. 866-546-5254.
We've been dating since high school. We never once left this town. We used to go out on the weekends, and we'd drink till we drown. But now she's acting funny, and I don't understand. I think that she's found some other man. She left me for Jesus, and that just ain't fair. She says that he's perfect. How could I compare? She says I should mind him, and I love peace at last. If I ever his ass. She showed me a picture. All I could do was stare. I had that freak in his sandals. Oh, with his long, dirty hair. They must think that I'm stupid. Or I don't have a clue. I bet he's a commie. Or even worse yet, a Jew. She left me for Jesus, and that just ain't fair. She says that he's perfect. How could I compare? She says I should find him, and I know peace at last. And if I ever I'm kicking his ass. She's given up whiskey and a tin of wine. While she prays for his troubles, I just forgot about my man. I'm gonna get even. I can't handle the shame. Well, last time we made love, she even called out his name. She left me for Jesus. Perfect.
got a gig on the radio from 10 a.m. to 2. I attack my country's enemies like the damned ACLU. And tree huggers and pinko rats and feminists and Democrats and every other threat to the old red, white and blue. I love my gig on the radio, I've got a lot of fans. They call me up and kiss my butt and tell me I'm the man. The other ones who don't agree, my screeners, keep away from me. To hell with all of them, they're not true Americans. I'm the voice of the people, a voice with manly tone. I've got 50,000 watts and a great big microphone. My hero is Rush Limbaugh, my enemy the left. I demonize the liberals, take home a big paycheck. My audience is buying and I'm always there to sell. Diet pills, gutter guards, some youth reviving gel. And timeshare opportunities in Panama and Belize. And a male enhancement product with the brand name Rebel Yell. Each day I use the microphone to blast the leftist creeps. The Clintons and Jane Fonda, Dixie Chicks and Meryl Streep. And though to war I didn't go, I was 4F if you must know. I like to dress in camouflage and drive an armored jeep. I'm the voice of the people, righteous and outraged. Invoking God and country and a freeze on minimum wage. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps, do what's good and right. And speaking of straps and boots, I might get a hooker for tonight.
Oh, yeah. Well, we're back with the Guy James Show. Thanks for joining us here this afternoon. Warm day in Florida. Warm day in lots of places. My God, I think it's about 100 degrees in New York City today, and close to the same thing in Washington, D.C., and up across the Midwest. It's still hot. Getting it early this year, aren't you folks? Well, 866-546-5254 if you'd like to join us on the program. A few emails we got talking about the valedictorian from Russia. Stewart writes, if the valedictorian had broken a law to benefit Junior, he might give him a pardon or commutation so he could stay. Otherwise, who knows? Well, that's exactly right. And John Astoji wanted me to remind everybody that it was on the Keith Olbermann show, talking about Bill Moyers last night. He's supposed to have Bill Moyers on his show either tonight or sometime this week. You know, I've had Bill scheduled a half a dozen times on this show, and it's been canceled for one reason or another every single time. Should I get a message from that? I'm not sure. One of my heroes in the media, no question about it, Bill Moyers. I was thrilled to get to see him not too long ago at the Take Back America concert, speaking. So that was a good thing. Tomorrow we're going to have Congressman McDermott on. Yes. Is that tomorrow? Okay. Yeah, that is tomorrow. And we're going to talk about the Emergency Extended Unemployment Compensation Act. We'll see if that gets any legs and gets passed. There's a lot of people in need of it. What was it? We lost, 49,000 more jobs this past month? Things are not looking real good. I don't know whether these people are getting all the stuff that the economy is rebounding. I don't know. 866-546-5254. I don't know if I have time to get into this today or not, but I guess I will. I'll make it brief. How many of you have heard about what Dick Cheney's trying to do with the Iraqis right now? Dick Cheney, the same Dick Cheney that runs the U.S. government. And I think there can be little question after hearing from Scott McClellan and really a plethora of people on Capitol Hill and all over the place in Washington, D.C., that Dick Cheney is the man in charge in the White House for whatever reason. What does Dick Cheney have on Bush or other people there? That's what I'd like to know. How did Dick Cheney succeed in appointing himself vice president and then taking the reins and getting through anything he wanted. That's puzzled me since the very beginning. I mean, I know the guy's always been good at backdoor policy, and that wasn't smart to say it wasn't backdoor policy. but he's always been very good at staying in the shadows and wielding power from the shadows. He's the kind of guy he knows what kind of a despicable persona he projects. And therefore, he stays in the background. He's just like the Wizard of Oz or Rosebud or, you know, all those in the movies. So, I would like to know what he has on everybody. But now this is coming out, this McClellan story. And then we've got Senator Pat Roberts, who was the head of the Senate Intelligence Committee. And he blocked this report that has now come out about Cheney. But we learned that Dick Cheney wants the puppet Iraqi government that was installed by the U.S. occupation to sign a security pact with Washington by the end of July. Have you heard about this? Have you read the details of this pact, what Cheney's trying to get the Iraqis to do? It's just remarkable that somebody would have the chutzpah to try and get the Iraqi, even a puppet government, to go along with this. And the Iraqi people, they're just now finding out about it, and of course they're pushing back against this. But this pact, which includes a status of forces agreement, would be signed by Junior Bush, but wouldn't constitute a treaty requiring congressional approval. See what's happening here? He's trying to make a treaty, not called a treaty, so that he doesn't have to get congressional approval for it. And U.S. Ambassador Ryan Crocker has been just working like hell to try and meet this deadline on this, which would commit the next administration to the agreement's terms. And it's not working so well right now. Prime Minister of Iraq, Maliki, says negotiations are only in the beginning stage, that public opinion is very opposed to this pact based on the leaked information they have about it, starting to leak out to the public. And a majority of members of the Iraqi parliament have endorsed a letter to the U.S. government demanding U.S. withdrawal as the condition for any commercial, agricultural, investment, or political agreement with the United States. And not very many Americans are familiar with this proposed treaty, and if they were, they might be shocked at its provisions. For if they were in the, if they did know about it, they'd be appalled. They would. And once again, our media has totally neglected its duty to inform the American citizens about a move of what can only, in my opinion, be called naked illegal aggression by the Bush administration. Here's what's contained in this pact that they're trying to shove down the Iraqis' throats, down their puppet government, Maliki, and the Iraqi parliament. Let me just name a few things that this pact says. It grants the U.S. long-term rights to maintain over 50 military bases, 50, in a country about the size of California, 50 military bases in Iraq. Long-term rights for the U.S. to have these military bases. It allows the U.S. to strike any other country from within Iraqi territory without permission of the Iraqi government. In other words, we can just use that as a nice jumping-off point to bomb anybody that we want from there. Mm-hmm. It allows the U.S. to conduct military activities in Iraq without consulting with local government. It allows U.S. forces to arrest any Iraqi without consulting with Iraqi authorities. It extends to U.S. troops and contractors immunity from Iraqi law. It gives U.S. forces control of Iraqi airspace below 29,000 feet. And it places the Iraqi Defense, Interior, and National Security Ministries under American supervision for 10 years. And it gives the U.S. responsibility for Iraqi armament contracts for 10 years. If you lived in Iraq, would you not be humiliated by this? Imagine, as an American, having to accept conditions like this from a foreign occupying power. Can you imagine how you would feel about that? What self-respecting people would ever agree to such provisions? Who would ever do that? I mean, their country's been illegally invaded, has been illegally occupied on the basis of lies. There's been maybe a million of them killed by the invaders and the civil strife that they've unleashed. 2 million have been driven into foreign exile. 2 million of them are internally displaced, homeless. Thousands have been humiliated, terrified, and tortured by the U.S. Millions of Iraqis' electrical and water supply isn't up to par of what it was during Saddam Hussein's level. They've lost jobs. They've lost human rights. Why on earth would their leaders sign such an agreement? Well, there's a reason why they would. And here's what it is. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York holds $50 billion of Iraq's foreign exchange reserves as a result of the UN sanctions dating back to the first Gulf War. And this $50 billion includes virtually all the oil revenues that under the UN mandate must be placed in the development fund for Iraq, controlled by the Iraqi government. Well, $20 billion of this money is owed to plaintiffs who've won court judgments against Iraq, but a presidential order, a U.S. presidential order, gives the account legal immunity. In other words, people can't take any of that $20 billion, but Bush can threaten to remove the immunity and wipe out 40% of Iraq's foreign reserves if Baghdad doesn't cooperate on what they're trying to shove down their throats. Now, Iranian political leader Rafsanjani really doesn't exaggerate in saying the proposed deal is designed to turn the Iraqis into slaves of the Americans and to create a permanent occupation. And many Iraqis who have heard the details of this Cheney proposal, they use the same language. How would you dare even suggest something like this to people? It's inconceivable to me that anybody could try and force this down the Iraqi government and then claim that, well, you know, we're trying to give you democracy. Yes, you know, we're a loving and benevolent government, we the Bush people, and we were just thinking, you know, a while back that maybe you'd like to have yourself some democracy over there. We'll come in and help you do it. We'll help you set it up. We'll kill a lot of your people, and we'll blow up a lot of your houses, and of course, your infrastructure. We'll totally wreck that, and we'll do all that because we care about you. We, the neocon Bush administration, we care about you, the Iraqis. That's at least that's what we've told our American compadres, that why we're coming over there and sending all these troops and mechanized death your way. And we're going to put in government. I know you went out to vote and all that, but we didn't really approve of some of the people that you went to put in. So we're going to help you along with that, too. And we're going to wall off part of your capital city. We're going to put up a big prison-type wall with the guard towers at the top, 11-foot cement wall, and surround Sadr City. And I don't know. We'll have a few of our contractors mow down a few of your folks by accident, of course. We didn't mean to do it. And we'll give them complete immunity. You can't touch them. And even if any of our people get a little overzealous and kill a few of your folks just for kind of fun, we won't do anything about that either. In the meantime, you're going to do what we tell you. You're going to take these 50 military bases and you're going to like it. You're going to let us use those military bases to strike anybody else within striking distance that we want to, probably make you a target of those folks. We'll conduct military activities in Iraq without consulting with the local government. We'll arrest any one of you that we want. And you know what? That old deal of having U.S. troops and contractors shooting the place up, if they feel like it, some of them, the rogues, not most of them, but the rogue element within them, giving them the immunity, you're going to continue to do that as well. And you're going to like it. And if you buy any arms, you're going to buy them from us. And you know what? You don't have any choice in this whole matter. None. Well, Sistani doesn't like it. Al-Hakim doesn't like it. Rafsanjani doesn't like it. El-Sadr doesn't like it. Nobody likes it. So they got old Maliki between a rock and a hard place. He can sign this agreement, try and get it through the parliament, and try and continue to receive U.S. support, personally. And that'll just strengthen the popular perception that he's a U.S. puppet, which he is. Or he can submit to the referendum demand and embarrass the U.S. He's going to lose either way. Either way, Maliki is headed for the door. I don't think there's any question about that. So there you go. There's something else Cheney's wanted done. He'll probably get it done. I don't know any reason why he wouldn't. Maliki's got to cooperate with him or else, and there else isn't a pleasant thought for the Iraqi people right now. Not at all. Something we're going to talk about tomorrow. I'm going to talk a lot about John McCain tomorrow. And I would like to, for you to think about it and maybe Google it and find out all you can about it in the meantime, but I find that John McCain, after refusing to vote for the GI Bill for our troops because, to quote him, it's too generous, that he is getting $58,000 a year tax-free from the U.S. government for his military service. That's about $2 million since Vietnam. And when asked about it, his staff said, well, he was tortured for his country. He was technically disabled, tortured for his country. Well, I can't deny that he was tortured for his country, and I can't deny that he served. But for a man to vote against a half-decent GI Bill for the people that are in the service right now, $58,000 a year he's getting himself for a disability. Is he disabled? Or does everybody that was in a prison camp get $58,000 a year? That's a question I'd like to know. I just found out about this shortly before the show today and didn't have a chance to do a lot of research on it. Is he totally disabled? Now, it would seem to me, I could be wrong, but it would seem to me if the man can campaign 7 days a week, work in the United States Senate, be an active politician, gets around real well, would seem to me that he's not totally disabled. I could be wrong. But my main point to that is, how can he, and if he's got a conscience at all, how could he vote against help for those that are in the military right now, getting an education, getting better health care when they get out? How could he possibly vote against that when he's collecting $58,000 a year himself? How can he do that? Just shows you what kind of a man John McCain really is. And we're going to talk a lot about John McCain tomorrow. A lot of good news coming out of the Barack Obama campaign and the DNC right now. They're saying that Barack Obama could raise as much as $100 million in campaign funds this month. This month? McCain's going to take the public financing and only going to be able to get $85 million? And Obama's going to be able to raise $100 million this month? Wow. So, hey, folks, now's the time. Now's the time. If we can overwhelm them with money, why, that'll help too. Normally that's not been the case with the Democratic candidate, but this time around, it's going to be. They will be able to overwhelm him with funds. They will be able to out-campaign him. They will be able to advance better ideas, better policies, better everything for the country than does John McCain. My, oh my, where's the time going today? I don't know. Obviously, you were content to let me do all the talking today, just about all of you. Maybe that'll be different tomorrow. We are going to talk a lot about John McCain tomorrow. I've done a lot of research on John McCain, his personal life, his public life. I've done a lot of research on that, and I want to talk about it tomorrow. There's some many issues with John McCain that I have that... reasons that he shouldn't even be a candidate for the presidency of the United States, let alone get the office, and he won't get it. Probably should just go ahead and say I'll stake my opinion and I will. I'll stake it on that one. I don't think he'll has a chance in hell of getting to be the president of the United States. I could be wrong. I'm against the grain on that, but I'll stake my reputation on that anyway. Thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it so very much. Always good to know that we've got a good audience. One thing about being on the Internet, we can tell exactly how many of you are there and all. We've had a nice audience today, so thank you. Thank you so much for tuning in and staying here for just the whole show. I love that. Listen to the Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network. Thanks to Billy Shears, our music director. Got Mark coming up. Bob coming up later on. Got a